this in a very direct way. All of us who love life, who love living in nature, have had at some point in our lives some transformational experience. And that can come at any time, but it's best received when you're out in that kind of environment where the quietness and the solitude can offer itself, the music of the land, the music of the water, the music of the planet, in a place that you can hear. So that's the intention of the longboats that we run. And we have two of them now. And communities up and down the Sound are contributing their effort and their energy, both money and time, to help support this network. The idea is that eventually we'll have a fleet of little boats, always maintaining a public eye on what's going on in Puget Sound. A theme for environmental studies is to think locally and act, or to think globally and act locally. And that's a theme of what we do as well. So what I am here for, my background educationally is I'm a student at Huxley College, where I graduated in 81, with time spent also at College of the Atlantic. And College of the Atlantic gives but one degree, and it's a degree in human ecology, which is a relatively new discipline. And what it seeks to do is understand human beings' relationship to the natural world and one another. Not in a cause and effect relationship necessarily, but almost the entire gestalt of how the planet works and what our place as the human community is in the larger world community. The theme for this week, my tenure here, is going to be on the state of the world, and we'll start off with an overview of the world's environmental macro problems, and then we'll winnow it down. Tomorrow we'll be talking about the Gaia hypothesis, which is a physiochemical hypothesis that leads to the question of whether the planet and life really matters, whether it matters if we're here, if we human beings are on the planet or not. Implicit in most all religions is the idea that a lot of what is out there for us, and it needs us to be there. And what hypotheses like the Gaia hypothesis are suggesting is that that ain't so. The planet may do just fine without us. We'll take it down. The next 3 days after tomorrow will be a series of solutions where we'll isolate particular areas where it can be shown that the human community can actually behave intelligently toward the planet and live within natural bounds. We'll be talking about sustainable agriculture, and on a personal level, we'll be talking about re-inhabiting place. And then the last day will be spent with what may be an emerging symbol and an emerging myth for the entire planet, and that's the Gaian hypothesis, the Gaian mythology, the image of the Earth as a whole. It's something that transcends religions, transcends political boundaries, geographic boundaries. More than at any other time in our history on this planet, our awareness as human beings is one of we are on a very small planet. And where there may be other planets and other lives somewhere out in that vast cosmos, this is our home. And what we do, each of us as individuals and collectively as nations, has tremendous bearing on what kind of life can be had here for not only us in the Western world, but for all life forms on the planet. I'm hoping this becomes more of a dialogue and rather than a lecture. And environmental studies has the sort of the reputation of being full of doom and gloom. And one of the things that we try and do is we try and lighten it up a little bit. So imagine, if you will, think back. How many of you have seen Music Man? You know, 76 drums, boom, boom. Okay. There's a wonderful scene in Music Man where the con man is trying to convince the people that they've got a problem. And the solution to the problem is they got to get musical instruments. They got to get their kids involved in something else. And the pool hall, the pool is the symbol of decadence. So, you're all from Emerald City. Citizens of Emerald City, your attention, please. Either you're closing your eyes to a situation you don't wish to acknowledge, or you're unaware of the caliber of disaster indicated by the presence of intelligence in your community. You got trouble, my friends. Trouble, right here, I say trouble, right here in Emerald City. Why, sure, there was a time when the fish and the sound were as thick as stones on the beach, and the trees grew tall and 10 feet wide, and the rain that fell from the sky didn't burn the evergreen soil. But I'd like to see you name just one problem here in the sound that doesn't come from the minds of men. Now, I'm an educated man, certainly. Mighty proud to say it, always mighty proud to say it. Why, consider the hours I spent with a book in my hand are golden. But just as I say, it takes judgment, brains, and maturity to lift humanity from the cave. The advent of civilization and the presence of the thinking mind are the first steps on the road to degradation. I say first, medicinal wine from a teaspoon. Why then, beer from a bottle? The next thing you know, you got mills on the water and a railroad line in town. Bringing in some out of town Jasper. Hear him tell tales about automobiles. Not a wholesome trotting pace, but a frantic life in the fast lane. Why, you got a rush to get home from work. Make your blood boil. Friends, let me tell you what I mean. We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 universities in the same town. Universities that make the difference between a scholar and a bum with a capital B. That rhymes with B and that stands for brains. Now all week long your Emerald City youth be frittering away. I say, your young folk will be frittering. A frittering away their noon time, supper time, chore time too. Sitting in school, ideas in mind, dreaming up inventions for God knows what. And that's trouble. That's lots and lots of trouble. Trouble with a capital T rhymes with B and that stands for brains. Now, I know all you folks are the right kind of parents. And I'm going to be perfectly frank. Would you like to know what kinds of notions are in engineering students' heads? Why they're dreaming up ways to get spots off a shirt without thinking of chemical waste. That's generations of our young trying to improve our lives with brand new chemical products and bragging about how they're going to cover up a telltale sign. Well, one fine night they'll leave the workspace for home on the sound, only to find they're living now on the banks of Love Canal. Friends, the active brain is the devil's playground. We got trouble. Oh, we got trouble. Right here in the right here. The capital T rhymes with B. That stands for brains. That stands for brains. We surely got trouble. We surely got trouble. Right here in the Emerald City. Right here. Gotta figure a way to keep the young ones normal after school. Our children's children's gonna have trouble. Parents of Emerald City, watch for the telltale signs of corruption. The moment your child leaves home from school, does he rebutton his shirt right up to the collar? Is there a pencil lodged behind her ear? Does she spend the afternoon hours memorizing the text of the TRS-80 owner's manual? Are certain words slipping into her lexicon? Words like awesome, rad, E=MC². Oh, if so, my friends, you got trouble. Oh, we got trouble. Right here in Emerald City. Right here in Emerald City. A capital T rhymes with B. It stands for brains. That stands for brains. We surely got trouble. We surely got trouble. Right here in Emerald City. Right here. Gotta figure a way to keep the young ones normal after school. Our children's children's gonna have trouble. Oh, we got trouble here. We got lots and lots of trouble. Expanding minds are in the hands of the devil's reins. Devil's reins. Oh, we got trouble, trouble, trouble. Oh, we got trouble here. We got big, big trouble. With a T, with a capital T. Rhymes with B, gotta rhyme with B. That stands for brains. That stands for brains. Well, I about said it all. Before we start plunging into the defeat and despair, I want to lead you through a brief visualization. And you can close your eyes or leave them open or whatever you prefer. But it's one thing to think of yourself as ending with your skin. And that's really not true. There's an old saying from a poet that we use in environmental studies that says a lot. The man said, you can't stir a flower without troubling a star. And the message there is that everything's connected in ways that we don't understand and ways that we're just beginning to learn. So what I want you to think about right now is the fact that at this very minute, surrounding us are millions and millions and millions of life forms going about their daily life, some living and dying in an instant. The soil outside this room is full with millions of organisms busy at work, reproducing, dying. At this minute, the world over, there are countless trillions of animals making their way home, just waking up, stretching. It is that vast network of life forms that we're just beginning to understand. One of the things that I'm very interested in, and something that I would like some feedback from you on, is the Christian community about 20 years ago was singled out, Christian doctrine anyway, about as being largely responsible for environmental decay on the planet. There's a philosopher named Lynn White who wrote a paper called The Historical Origins of Environmental Crisis. And in that he said that the traditional Christian interpretation of man having dominion over the planet has led to a separation of human beings from the rest of the biotic and abiotic community. That is an issue that the church addressed largely in the forms of stewardship, coming up with, instead of Genesis 1, I think it is, in Genesis 2, they talk about in the garden and being stewards of the planet. And that's gone a long way to helping people reinterpret their relationship to the planet, that maybe it's not all put out there just for our use, to use up. Maybe there is an idea of compassion, of management, implicit in that. A couple of years ago in Assisi, they had a meeting of the great world religions, and the question was, okay, what about your religion and the environmental problems of the planet? Where do you stand? Of the five great religions, three of them, Judaism, Christianity, and the Muslim community, all had this idea of management. We are here kind of to manage this creation. And there are varying interpretations of what happens if you mismanage it. Two of the great religions, Buddhism and Hinduism, don't make that distinction. They see themselves as part of a continuum of life, on par with all other life. The ideas of reincarnation are some expression of that. And it's something that Jerry will be talking about tonight, is what is the Christian response still to that great and growing problem of the environment on Earth? And what can the church do about that? What sort of resources can it bring to bear to help out what is growing, looming as a very, very serious situation? For the first time on the planet, we don't have just localized environmental problems. There isn't just a famine in India. There isn't just a landslide here. There isn't just a gigantic flood that left 25 million homeless in Bangladesh. There isn't just a tidal wave. Now, we have a situation where fossil fuel burning in Europe drifts over and destroys forests in neighboring countries. We have a situation where the same kind of fuel burning in our industrial heartland of this country is causing havoc in Canadian lands, Canadian forests and lakes, aquatic systems all over. We have technological disasters like Chernobyl, which poisoned Europe. You know, let's face it, they've just made the decision to completely destroy the community over there, the town that surrounded Chernobyl. It's contaminated. But it's not just there. All the way up to Lapland and elsewhere. And we have what many of you are probably familiar with in the ozone, global warming. How many of you have heard of that in the press? Ozone depletion? Okay. That's one of the biggies, and it's serious because there's this phenomenon called lag time. And lag time means that by the time a problem is recognized and the information that's required to understand the problem is synthesized and some decision is made, and the decision comes out in statements like the Montreal Protocol, the time that action takes place on a political level and a societal level, and the time that it takes effect is many years distant. A lot of the chemicals that are going up in the atmosphere right now, they don't get up there for 6 to 8 years. And some of them last over 100 years in their ability to destroy ozone. So the situation is real serious. By the time that the general community understands what's going on, and they take action, The worry is that it's too late. And that's unprecedented. It's the first time in the history of this planet that there is unanimity among scientists that, yes, the ozone layer is decaying. Yes, the cause is anthropogenic. It's us. We've looked at a lot of other sources. Some factor into it. But the major problem is us. And yes, we need to do something, and we need to do it fast. Well, what I'd like to do is open this up a little bit. Give me your favorite environmental catastrophe. What's going on in the planet?
James Watt was appointed.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
Destruction of the rainforest.
Yeah, the rainforest. Okay, how about another one?
What Exxon does with drunken sailors.
So let's make a big category of that. Sort of chemical contamination of the earth? Something like that? Is that a big enough? There was a woman here from Germany, I think. Is there anyone here from Europe? I'd like to hear from you what's going on in the Rhine. Wasn't it the Rhine that had that gigantic pesticide chemical spill fire? In Switzerland, I think. Yeah. Okay. How about another one?
Water pollution.
Okay. Think of, by the way, there are only four things necessary for life. And if I had a little bit of dirt, I'd be holding three of them. If I opened my hands, I'd have the four. And you need soil, you need water, you need air, and you need some form of energy. So within each one of those realms, there have been assaults, mostly by the human community, but not exclusively. How about some others?
The fertilizer that's been going down for agricultural land.
Okay, let's lump that under a big category of land degradation.
So does that include erosion then, too?
Yeah. Yeah, we'll further delineate these in just a minute.
Not foundation.
Yeah, this includes erosion, over-cultivation, overgrazing. We mentioned the ozone, so let's put that up here. Delta sign just means change, atmospheric change. Any others?
Air pollution.
Okay, we'll lump this in here. There are some non-traditional ones.
Talking about waste disposal and hazardous waste disposal.
Electromagnetic energy.
Something we haven't looked at yet, but it could be used on nuclear fusion.
As an environmental problem or a contributor?
We don't know. It possibly could be. If it comes to pass.
Let's put that up under chemical wonders. Yeah, there's one that... You know, it's funny, during the tenure of Reagan, you hardly heard anything about population. In fact, you hardly heard anything about the environment. It was good old times.
No, noise pollution.
Noise pollution. Yeah.
Purposefully killing off certain animals, like the gray wolves. And Yellowstone, now they want to bring them back. Because, you know, it's messing up the ecological order. Just to me, animal convention.
How could we paraphrase?
The expansion of an animal every 30
years. Over-management, I mean.
Okay, let's lump it into that larger category of species extinction.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you put it with population. There's some populations are going up and some are going down.
Yeah, there's two problems. There's the absolute elimination of species, and then there's the diversification. That's a problem. You can eliminate a lot of species from... It's a problem with forestry. We used to have this idea that, clear cuts are fine in the Northwest, because we know from ecology that you get the most abundant species when you have edges. If I were to offer a prize of $100,000 to go out and find where you find the most species, you go to the edge of something. Margins, coral reefs. They're margins, interface areas, ecotones, they call them. Well, what they didn't think about was, okay, well, we've got the same kind of system in these little patchwork of clear-cut areas. What we're losing is an overall species diversity within the whole forest system. And the argument, how many of you are from Washington? Okay, the argument, wow, where are the rest of you from?
Oregon.
Minnesota. The argument over the spotted owl. Spotted owl is largely the straw dog. It's the red flag that people are holding out. It's only a symbol of a much, much larger issue. And the argument is being couched in terms of, look, we've got this one lousy animal that's preventing X many people and N much dollars from happening in the economy, which is needed, and on and on and on and on. That's the way the argument is being couched, and that's really not what the issue is. Okay, well, there's a big one, and it's one of the growing problems worldwide. It's so new that they don't really even have statistics on it, except World Watch has done some research on environmental refugees. You've heard of political refugees. All those people who fled Chernobyl are environmental refugees. All the people, this atmospheric change, what's happening, we'll get into this in just a minute, but in the next century, sea levels are predicted to rise anywhere from 1 meter to 2.5 meters, and that's only an average. It'll be higher in other places. Well, you have a tremendous percentage of the world's population that live, guess where? In coastal areas and floodplains. Holland, yeah. Marshall Islands. Although Seattle had a unique solution to the Marshall Islands. Seattle was going to ship its garbage to the Marshall Islands, build up their soil, so the Marshall Islanders wouldn't get washed away. We'd conveniently get rid of our garbage. That's still a plan. They still want to do that. Plus, the Marshall Islanders would get rich, too, by our pollution. So, environmental refugees is another very, very large... I wish I had a large board, because what would be fun to do is to tie these things together. These are not isolated. They all impact one another. You have people who are fleeing Ethiopia, other places of marginal existence, and they're looking for a better life. Or let's take a case that's happening even more dramatically. When the big flood went down through Bangladesh and left 25 million homeless, you know where they went? They went across the border. Well, when they go across the border, it's not like there isn't anyone else there. They're crowding into already marginal lands. All of them trying to eke out some meager existence, which causes not only political strife, social strife, but it degrades what land might be there. You don't just have a drought in Africa. What happens in Africa when you have a drought is people shift from their already marginal existence of farming, and they supplement their income by cutting down the trees. Well, when you cut down the trees and the rains start falling again, you've removed a critical plant in the whole hydrologic system that helps the soil retain the water. So the message is that you're through with the drought, the rains have come, aha, we're going to start farming again. Gee, it's not working anymore. And the mystery, the element there, is they've cut down all the trees. So you have more people that leave their homeland. We in the United States are so far removed from the kind of impoverishment of most of the world that it's hard to imagine. And that, again, is an ethical question, a moral question, I think, that the church needs to address. Can we afford? Can it be ethically okay, even if you have the money individually, to go out and buy a new car, our second car, or a third car, or a car that doesn't get good gas mileage, when the implications for the rest of the world are very adverse? So we have that on the one hand. The other hand, we have the Office of Transportation. That's just in the process of lowering the mileage limitations on automobiles. We should be going the other way. We should be having cars that get a minimum of 50 miles per gallon. And the Office of Transportation is just in the process of going the other way. They're saying, well, let's relax some of these for light trucks and some other classes of automobiles. Worldwide now, people want to be like us. I mean, we're tremendously successful. I mean, among all civilizations on the planet, we in the Western world are the ones that are emulated, admired, looked up to. Everybody wants to be like us. Well, what do we have? We have cars. We're tremendously, tremendously wasteful. I was real encouraged when I came to Holden Village here, and I noticed that a lot of the emphasis here is on a reduction in the amount of energy that's used. It's on recycling things. And I'm going to encourage all of you to take part in that garbology scene that happens here. If there's anything that will give you an experiential message of what it's like to deal with a lot of waste and ways that you can deal with that, that's a good one. There's a lot of good things going on here. There's also a little map in the Eating Commons on the south, on the west wall. It talks about the food policy of Holden. And that's another environmental tenet that needs to be followed by more and more people. They're eating lower on the food chain. That means that more people can be fed with the same amount of energy. Okay, well, where are we? Have we left anything out?
Doesn't most of that dump into the oceans? Not the oceans.
Yeah, we forgot about the water.
Yeah, let's dump everything in the ocean. We don't know what to do.
So hydrologic contamination, which is the whole water budget. Obviously, this and this and this are intimately related. You cut down more trees, the ability of the network of water, instead of going into the soil and evaporating off the trees, evaporating out of the land, getting back up into the sky, and water goes in the drainage areas and it runs off, and it's lost from the water budget. That's going to happen in Brazil if the climatic models that they're doing, which have predicted a lot of this greenhouse effect and the temperature rise, if they are followed, what they say are borne out, Brazil is going to experience some very, very catastrophic changes in its climate. Just from this, you'll have whole areas of Brazil that their water budget would be so disrupted that they won't be able to support the kind of plants that were there. Well, let me check my list against what World Watch has to say. Oh, yeah. Something sort of fundamental. How about food? Put that one right in here. Yeah, food's what drives it. We, as a species, just like all other species, we go where there's food, water, shelter, and air. And when you run out of this, you go to extremes. This feeds this in a very direct way. As people become more and more desperate, they farm more and more marginal lands. As more marginal lands are farmed, especially in the absence of any kind of control or conservation strategies, those lands erode, and then they're removed. They're removed from their food-producing ability. Another aspect of land degradation is something called desertification. That's literally the encroachment of deserts upon once arable lands. And it's happening at an alarming rate. Much of it for food, and much of it related in the sub-Sahara area to people cutting down the trees, trying to eke out a meager existence by selling charcoal.
Back when the U.S. cut down a lot of their forests, which sort of ecological changes occurred?
Well, some are too early to tell. I mean, there's a tremendous species elimination when you eliminate a lot of habitat on the East Coast. And you've changed a lot of the land that the forest helped to maintain, got worn out. Worn out quickly. Here in the West, that I'm more familiar with, there is a great evidence that says that the health of the soil is really maintained by the old growth forests. Not so much by the trees, but by the conditions that they set up, and more importantly, the mushrooms, the mycelium, that are in the forest, actually in the forest floor. And the mycelia that extend in these vast networks of miles and miles and miles and miles and miles don't grow in other kinds of forests, at least not the same kind of pattern. And there's a growing body of evidence that says that, ironically enough, really shamefully enough, we talk about Brazil mining the trees of the Amazon, and our temperate rainforests are of critical importance as well. And we're butchering them at an alarming rate. All up the West Coast, British Columbia. So there are those changes. You got one?
I just keep thinking, you know, the Native Americans lived here, what, 15, 25,000 years? Virtually unchanged. The ecosystem, and here we are, 216 years old. Everything we're writing up here on the board, and things that we're going to have to change radically in our lifestyles and the way we handle business ventures. And,
yeah.
At least that. I mean, they were telling us all along, you know, what to watch out for, what, you know. And their idea, you never drink water below a white man's camp, white person's camp. And, you know, they knew that a long time ago, and just how we break the village.
Yeah, this is a Native American saying. The frog doesn't drink up the puddle in which it lives. We have this curious history of coming into an area and overusing it so intensively that it's just mind-boggling. And there are, as he pointed out, there are societies that have been upon this planet that have lasted for thousands of years in some sort of harmony with the environment. A lot of it is based right here. One of the lessons of ecology is this idea of carrying capacity. It's like this room. This room only takes so many people, and then there's enough room. That's it. Well, when you're dealing with a dynamic system like land that fluctuates over time, you have years of drought, you have years of plenty, changes that occur, you have some sort of carrying capacity that the land can support. And the word is that Africa's over it. It's way over it.
Well, we have this great American myth that the Americans can solve any problem. We can do anything and we'll come up with some clever solution for it, and I do not believe this is true. We'll come up with a solution, but what will we destroy with the solution? You know, I mean, this is what we've been doing, solving problems so we can keep our high lifestyle and destroying
all problems. Solving problems with technology instead of going back to basics.
Right.
Yeah.
Destroying.
Anybody have any thoughts on why that is? What's so alluring about technology that way?
High level of living, or high income.
I wonder if it isn't some sort of deep-seated expression of wanting to become divine.
Control, ego, living out of ego.
I was reading about the building of the Panama Canal. What an incredible undertaking. And the idea of the country was that, hey, you bet, we can do this. We can do this, and this is amazing, and we're going to change the course of the planet. And the engineering community got I mean, they did it. It's an amazing thing that they did. But the idea was that, look, we're onto something that's really, really hot here.
We need to build bigger, faster roads.
Yeah, and probably the most alarming expression of that has happened since World War II. And it happens in the chemical industry. After the war was over and there was a lot of research that had been done on mostly petroleum-based chemicals, they got applied to agriculture, and there are these tremendous changes. You had a problem with bugs here. Take a look at this. Splat. And next year, by God, the crop yields went up tremendously. Well, if I'm a farmer, an individual farmer, and I have somebody that comes along and says, hey, you got a problem with this bug eating all your crops? Look, I got this stuff here, and I'll give it to you this year. Sell it to you real cheap. And it works. You'll see that it works. And I spray it on there. By God, it works. And it works real well. The next time he comes around with another little product that he wants to give me, you bet I'll try it. And it worked. It worked just great. Mostly applied to cotton in the early years. And it's only recently that we found out how interconnected things are. We start to lose our predators. You have people like Rachel Carson writing Silent Spring about how that chemical stuff works up in the food chains. It gets into us. We're the top level eaters, along with some other animals, peregrine falcon, which started to decline. Eggshells got weak and thin. We started looking at, okay, that's happening out there. What's happening to us? And your name's Kenneth? He's a doctor who's giving sessions that we are in the midst of our own environmental decay caused by ourselves. That famous line out of Pogo, we have met the enemy and he is us. We're victims of our own success in many, 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 many ways. So the challenge is, do you have to throw out all the technology? At what level do people have to live? And that's, in a couple of days, we'll be talking about this thing called sustainable agriculture, which, it's an idea that's already working, it's already in place, people are already doing it. But the idea that you can use the best that you know from science and technology and from what you know about animal and plant husbandry, and you can live within the bounds of the environment, and you can have a good life. It's possible to do that. Especially here in the West, on a world level, the stakes are much, much higher and much more shaky.
When she said that the American myth is there, that we can do everything and we can remedy the situation, and then went on to say that she doesn't believe that anymore, it really evokes a great crisis, because what she is saying is also true. The American myth is dead. She doesn't believe it anymore. For a myth to have full vitality, really everybody has to believe it. And it's like the story of the emperor's clothes. Just takes one person to say, hey, look, the emperor doesn't have any clothes. But the crowd is still addicted to saying, gee, the emperor has beautiful clothes.
Yeah.
And they will continue to say that because they think that that's what's required for their survival. But we're in a state now, I think, of just pending terror, because our working myth is death. But we don't know where to go now. I mean, I sit here and listen to you, and I look at that board up there, and the whole time, my heart has just been pounding because I don't see the way, and yet I can't deny the reality. It's just like the addicted person to chemicals. That person almost invariably knows that the chemical that he or she is addicted to is almost fatal and will continue to use it. It's a real terrifying kind of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of like the idea of sin. I'm not raised in a practicing Christian tradition, my confession. And my background is, my folks were Unitarians, and I never did find out what that meant. And in high school, I had a fellow who came and stayed at her house who was a practicing Zen Buddhist and did Tai Chi. Well, I do Tai Chi now, but as far as the Zen Buddhism part went, what I remember is I get up at 7 o'clock in the morning, drag myself sleepily out of bed, walk past George, who had been sitting there for 2 hours at least, meditating. And I never quite understood that either. I understand it more now. But my pursuit has been, in this larger area of human ecology, is, okay, well, what is going on? How did we get into this mess, anyway? And what might we do about it? What does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to be a human being, as an animal? We've had a number of earth-shattering and ego and image shattering revolutions on this planet. One of them came back a long time ago with this guy named Copernicus, and he said, hey, it ain't so. The sun doesn't travel around us anymore. We travel around the sun. And then came along this guy Darwin. He said, you know, we're a lot closer to those animals than you think. In fact, we're an animal. And that was earth-shattering to people, that idea of us being so intimately connected to the rest of the animal world. And then there was Freud, sort of the third grand one, who said, there's this other part to your psyche that is a part that most of us would rather not look too closely at. What is it that drives us to do the things that we do? I question that myself. When I know that I'm doing something that I don't really believe in, I don't really feel, I wonder why I'm doing it. And the pursuit of the answer to that question took me into the field of ethology. And ethology was the study of animals in their natural setting. I said, okay, look, I'm an animal, I believe that. And I believe I have some common heritage with other animals, so what is that? For a long time, we just studied animals in laboratories. And we tortured mice and said, yeah, look what they're doing. And then we used that as a reflection of, well, see, you know, humans do that too. And then a bunch of these guys said, it doesn't work that way. We've got to go out and watch animals in their natural setting and see what happens. So, as a history of environmental how comes, there are three other big problems. I just looked on my list. We seem to have an overwhelming urge toward status that we share in common with many, many other animals. You look through the anthropological literature on the planet, and there are few societies you can find in which status does not figure very importantly. On the northwest coast here, the Native Americans were characterized by one anthropologist as megalomaniac paranoid. They were so preoccupied with rank and status that they give away all their wealth, everything they had, to assure their status within the tribe. I do a lot of theater work, and whenever you get into a theater, one of the exercises that you'll do is status work. Every scene that you do has some implicit message of status. Another one that seems to be common with us, and it's one of those things that we've got to transcend, I believe, is this idea of territoriality. We have a territory that we will defend against all others. And it stops here. I said that the emerging myth may be one of the planet as our home. If we have people thinking that way, when they take an action, as the planet as being home, then territory is kind of dissolved. So there's a couple of things. Well, we left out a couple other ones. There's this big one, another big P, let's see. I think the Christian community is familiar with poverty, being a religion of the disenfranchised. Poverty is what drives a tremendous amount of environmental decay. People scratching for a living, each one individually, trying to make their way through life, contributing to an environment that in the long run may not sustain them. How many of you have ever heard the tragedy of the commons? Well, the story is that in England, they used to have towns that had a common area, a common pasturage for their stock animals. And it could support a certain amount of life. And it could support it through the fluctuations of time, of weather, feed. Well, that idea was picked up by a guy named Garrett Hardin, who wrote an essay of that title, The Tragedy of the Commons, and said, let's suppose that we're all farmers around that field, and we can see, we've got our individual cow out there, and we can see that our individual cow is doing just fine. And, in fact, all the cows are doing fine. Now, what happens if I get the bright idea of putting another cow out in the field? My individual gain, my marginal gain, has increased 100-fold. I have 2 cows out there now. And still, the pasturage is doing just fine. Well, you see that I'm gaining economic riches and advancing my station and doing all those other things that money can give for you, and you say, well, hey, let's put another cow out there. Okay, well, we put another cow out there. Pasturage is still doing fine. Well, by and by, everyone puts another cow out there. Now the pasturage is not doing as well. But people are caught. They're caught to the point where they need to say, I got to put another cow out there just to maintain what I got. And you have another cow. We have everybody working on an individual level to the detriment of the commons that supports everyone. We have commons here still in our country that are very important. Air. Water. We don't know what to do about those commons. We've tried everything from selling pollution rights in California, where we said, look, you can have, I mean, industry, you can pollute that about as much as you want. And that'll be your thing. And if you want to buy more pollution rights into that area, you've got to establish, you've got to reduce somewhere else. So we've tried to create zones, atmospheric zones of pollution. Well, that's had some success, but it doesn't stay put. You know, this stuff roams around the planet. They're trying to do that in Puget Sound right now. The industry push was, let's create zones of degradation. We'll call them Elliott Bay in Seattle, and we'll call them Commencement Bay in Tacoma, and we'll call them Possession Sound up in Everett, and we'll just, I mean, industry is already there, and we'll just let it be filthy rotten. And that's going before the legislature right now, that kind of idea.
Are you talking about dredging the sound right now?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a subject that I'm actually, as a system, I'm most familiar with the sound. You can draw a lot of analogies there, but yeah, that's the old phrase, you want to let sleeping dogs lie? A lot of these toxins have been washed down for centuries, for a long time. We haven't even been out here for centuries, but for a long time, into the sediments of the sound. We found out that, contrary to popular belief, the sound doesn't flush with the ocean, as if the ocean was someplace that we could legitimately dump our waste. But it doesn't flush. It doesn't flush nearly as well as we thought. There's a layer of fresh water, or less saline water on top. Sediment comes in, toxic chemicals and heavy metals adsorb, glom onto the sides of these sediments, and they sink to the bottom. They get into the bottom feeding and bottom dwelling animals, which work their way up to the food chain, but eventually they get covered with other sediment. Then you have the Navy wants to come in and build a home port in Everett. Well, you got deep draft vessels, you have to have a deep harbor. And they want to come in and dredge up all this stuff, put it into solution again. Largely take the dredge spoils out in the Straits of Juan de Fuca, where it's deep, and dump it again. And it's caused a lot of concern. They have done that some places successfully in local areas that are shallow, where they've capped polluted areas with clean fill. And in essence, taken it out of the system. Let me put up my couple other ones here. How about this one? Dun-dun-dun-dun. Yeah, AIDS. AIDS is a global thing. It doesn't just happen here. And the impact that it will have on the world community is much more dramatic than what will happen here. Yeah?
This is a pressing concern right now, but I kind of wonder about the lack of policy towards states and the stuff we're, you know, throwing, you know, up there and leaving, the garbage we're leaving there. It seems like we're kind of going to repeat.
Yeah, that's another great American myth. Out of sight is out of mind. And it used to be that when you had big stuff, that kind of worked. And you had big things and you could push them off the edge of a cliff and you didn't really have to think about it. But we've gone down to the very small level now, where we have chemicals that are so fine that get trapped in the biological cycling system that they don't go away. And space is just another extension of that. What's the proposal to do with nuclear waste? One of them. One of the proposals to deal with nuclear waste? Yeah. Zap it to the sun. Put it in a ship and boom it out there. Send it back home. Well, there's another big, big, big factor that upsets the stability of the world, and that's all the saber rattling that goes on. The militarization of the world is a tremendously unstable event. It's unstable for a variety of reasons. Among them, when you put resources into the military, you're not putting them in other places. You're not putting them in programs that are trying to mitigate land degradation and desertification. To give you an idea of the solutions to this, it's estimated that we need to plant about 15 billion trees to halt this. That's a year. That's just to help stabilize soil, help stabilize local economies. Is there a question there? Gotta be careful when you wiggle. So, well, that's kind of it in a nutshell. Aren't you glad you came?
I want to say, for anybody who wonders, I was here at Holden 11 years ago when they were trying to become self-sufficient in every way. And right at that time in the church library was a book written by a Lutheran for Lutherans who said, hey, let's get off the nerds around and stuff and not buy all this materialism and things. And I'm realizing this is 11 years later. And the situation, you know, he said, if this many people would stop and say, hey, we are not going to buy anything more than what we absolutely need, it could have a major effect. But of course, it has not happened.
Yeah, when I look at what possible solutions are, and I think of the potential of Christianity to adopt the tenets of a sustainable society, and to teach that to their children, to take that out in the world. I think, man, what a tremendous gift. I mean, if anything, it's not going to be the governments that save us, folks. Governments have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo to the very last second. If you look closely at the Montreal Protocol, as an amazing document as it is, and what it talks about is cutting CFCs, the chlorofluorocarbons that are getting up into the ozone, depleting the ozone. It's full of loopholes. It doesn't call for nearly enough reduction. It's still an amazing document. There's an old saying among populist leaders that runs, when the people lead, the leaders follow. And that's really true. When you look at what's happening worldwide on a solutions level, it's happening locally. It's happening with little groups that are getting together and addressing specific problems. It's happening in Kenya, where a women's collective has mobilized 15,000 villagers to plant trees. It's happening, it's happening all over the world where people are going in with different kinds of cropping techniques, where they're planting leguminous trees near the croplands. So the trees not only feed the people in their charcoal and wood needs, but they're also, the legumes help prepare the soil for better crops. And that's the way it really works. In a nutshell, that's the solution. It happens locally. So the phrase of think globally, act locally, you use that as your mantra when you step around, it works. That's what we did with the sound. We thought, well, okay, you know, we got a big problem here in Puget Sound. What is it that I can do to address that problem in a meaningful way? And we're doing what we can. We'll see what kind of effect it has. Puget Sound is kind of a microcosm of the larger world. We're a very attractive area out here, apparently, to people in the United States, and we have another million people coming here in another 15, 18, 20 years. There's 3 million odd people that live in the basin right now. Another million people coming into that basin, all of them making demands on the Sound and its various habitats and systems, is going to be a tremendous impact. And nobody really knows what to do about it. I mean, they have some ideas. What we can do is we can do a lot of education. We can do a lot of fact-finding, which brings up another problem. Who do you believe? How many times do you listen to the radio and you hear expert A say, there's ozone, it's all your fault. And you come over here and expert B and says, no, it really has to do with seal poop from the Antarctic that's causing the ozone to decay. And I've got studies that document it, and it's really not our fault. Well, who do you believe in all this stuff? It's the story of the Mullah Nasruddin kind of comes to mind, and it's The Mullah Nasruddin, in the age of limited transportation, undertook a tremendous journey. He went to the great city to see the king, the emperor. And the town waited and waited and waited expectantly for his return. Finally, one day, they saw him coming over the hill. Now, the entire town came out to greet the mullah. And in a very regal fashion, he raised his hand, the crowd quieted down. And he said, "The emperor spoke to me." The crowd was amazed. And they all got up and they went off to their various parts of the city to talk about this incredible event where the emperor had actually spoken to a member of their town, all except a fool who was sitting there. And he said, what did his highness say? And the mullah leaned over and he said, "I was sitting on the steps of the imperial palace when the emperor came out in a great hurry and bumped into me. And he said, 'Get out of my way, you fool.' And the message for me in that is that I don't believe everything I read. You have to uncover a lot more layers of fact before you sort through what's propaganda and what's really going on in the world. A lot of this is, this is full of it. And the things that we compromise under the name of national security, the programs that dolphins. Bite the dust because of that.
Like dolphins.
Yeah.
It's right.
Yeah.
Doug, what is electromagnetic energy and how is it a pollutant problem?
I'm going to field that one to you.
Microwave, radio, television, we're bombarded constantly. High power tension wires, all of that. And there's an enormous amount of evidence now about its carcinogenic effects.
We're essentially electrochemical.
That's right. Einsteinian medicine is that we are electromagnetic beams. I mean, if you look at the new physics and all of that, so that all just disrupts our whole system. And an enormous amount of research now.
I understand that the Soviet Union, way back when, decided not to go with microwave transmission.
They're way ahead of us on the electric magnetic field around people. And there's loads of beautiful things with planets. This speaking to is really true. They measured the electrical waves. How the planets respond. They're way ahead of us.
Are you saying that the electromagnetic, the TV and radio and all that screws up our physiochemical processes and our nerve endings?
Yes. Absolutely. Marconi, when the radio first came out, had more death threats than any other person in history because there was a lot of illness in people when they began to beam radio waves and all that sort of thing. We've adapted a lot, but cancers, all kinds of things related.
Oh. Well, it's 5 o'clock. Hey! Now, don't anyone float out of the room out of this uplifting
Thanks.
Session, and make sure you come back.
My father's a lot of his father.